Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. The Supreme Court has weakened executive agencies' ability to regulate and make policy. No agency is more affected than the Environmental Protection Agency. What's next for environmental protection? Traditionally, the U.S. Supreme Court has given executive branch agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency, quite a bit of latitude at enforcing congressional legislation. This principle is called Chevron deference. But in this term, the Supreme Court weakened this principle significantly, in particular in the area of environmental protection. In West Virginia v. EPA, the court signaled that the EPA can only enforce on areas specifically outlined by Congress. And specifically, it weakened the agency's ability to take regulatory steps to combat climate change. On today's show, we will discuss what this means for the EPA, for public policy, and for the U.S.'s ability to make international commitments on the environment. Our panel is Joel Mintz, Professor Emeritus of Law and C. William Trout Senior Fellow in Public Interest Law at Nova Southeastern University Law Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He is the author of Enforcement at the EPA, High Stakes and Hard Choices. Richard Pete Andrews is a faculty fellow of the Institute for the Environment and Professor Emeritus at the Department of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He is the author of Managing the Environment, Managing Ourselves, A History of American Environmental Policy. And Pamela Chasick, professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Manhattan College in New York. She is the author of Global Environmental Politics. Thank you all for joining us. So I think I'd like to start with Professor Andrews. You've written about sort of the history of the EPA and the role it's played in managing environmental protection. Where did the EPA come from, and what typically has its role been in environmental protection?
Well, the EPA was created in 1970 by President Richard Nixon, with the consent of Congress, but simply by not vetoing it. And Nixon had actually originally proposed to create a Department of the Environment, or thought about creating a Department of the Environment, but that wasn't going to fly for political reasons. So instead, he created the EPA, which pulled together the programs dealing basically with pollution and toxic substances, pulling several from the what was then the Public Health Service domain and the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, some water programs from the Interior Department, the safety aspects of nuclear power from the Atomic Energy Commission, and one or two other things. And so that was 1970. And then through the 1970s, Congress passed, under the influence of Earth Day and the huge bipartisan support of the American people or doing more about the environment. The states had not stepped up. Many of them had not stepped up yet. And just where the attempts to get environmental regulation through the states just weren't working adequately. And so through 1970s, Congress passed a dozen or more sweeping laws federalizing these problems, making it the responsibility of the federal government and specifically of the EPA to manage water pollution, air pollution, solid and hazardous wastes, pesticides and toxic substances, and so forth. And those were passed by a sweeping bipartisan majority, with very few objections to it, and signed most of them by Republican presidents, Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. So that was a period number one, of very significant laws. In this case, for example, the air pollution laws were what one might call the significant federal laws of that time. They were dealing with major questions, unquestionably, federalizing air pollution management and so forth. And so Congress knew what they were doing, and that law does actually mention climate, but only briefly.
And then, Professor Mintz, from a legal perspective then, Professor Andrews referenced what was referenced actually in the law itself, but the EPA was given a pretty broad mandate, you know, to interpret this legislation, and really there was very little restriction, correct, on what the EPA could do?
Right. They had a lot of flexibility under the approach that was taken initially. That's correct. I had some problems with the West Virginia v. EPA opinion, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who had problems with it. Certainly the dissenting judges did as well. For one thing, the opinion severely limits EPA's ability to redress climate change because it rejects the approach that the agency had taken under a provision of the Clean Air Act, Section 111D, a provision that didn't discuss or refer to climate change directly, but which had implications that the agency had considerable flexibility. Also, the opinion relies on a novel legal approach, the so-called major questions doctrine. And that seems to give federal courts license to strike down federal agency regulations anytime Congress has given the agency's flexibility to establish regulatory rules. So it's a very broad power, I wouldn't say power grab, but very, very, very broad control of power taken by the court. And it upends the longstanding arrangement under which Congress delegates to expert agencies the authority to investigate, identify, and regulate problems that Congress itself lacks the institutional capacity to do itself. Congress is not composed of experts in any particular area, but agencies are experts by definition and by congressional authorization. And yet their power has been really diminished significantly under this opinion. In the environmental area, that's true, but it's not limited to the environment, really. The implications of it go well beyond environmental protection to pretty much every regulatory area, everything from, you know, transportation to consumer protection and on and on.
Yes, Pete Andrews.
Yeah, if I could add to that, I mean, I agree with everything that Joel Mintz just said. And it's really extraordinary that in addition, the court took on this case in a case where of a regulation which has been, it was basically moot at this point because it's not being, Biden has said that his administration will present a new rule, not yet presented, so no, he doesn't know what that is. Normally, the court doesn't decide, you know, non-cases like this. It decides cases and controversies. It doesn't issue advisory opinions. But both Obama's rule and Trump's rule are no longer in play. And so it took this on. It seems to me that, you know, Congress can speak for itself. If it thinks that the EPA has gone too far in addressing a major question they don't like, Congress can speak for itself and say, no, you can't do that, or no, we won't fund that. But for the courts to step in this way, for the Supreme Court to jump into this issue and arrogate to judges the capacity to say what is or isn't a major question that Congress, you know, has decided, I think is just an outrageous abuse of the court's flexibility.
Yeah, I want to return to that question in just a few minutes, but I do want to bring Pam Chase again, because one of the aspects of this case is that to get action on climate, specifically the Paris Climate Accords, the U.S. had signaled there was terribly little hope that Congress would pass a treaty that would mandate action. So instead, the Obama administration kind of took it upon themselves, you know, to use executive action to try to implement a voluntary approach. Does this case pretty much take that option away from the United States in any sort of future climate action?
It doesn't take in the options away, but it makes it a lot more difficult. So just by way of a little bit of a background, that the way the Paris Agreement was negotiated was that the commitments that governments take are purely voluntary. However, what is legally binding is the reporting. So, and this was done because, as you said, that the Obama administration did not believe that Congress would, the Senate would ratify a new climate agreement. Similarly, they had not ratified the Kyoto Protocol to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So this approach was taken to essentially ensure that the United States would be able to be a party of the Paris Agreement. And John Kerry, who was Secretary of State at the time, worked very hard on this leading up to Paris. So putting aside the 4 years of 2016 to 2020, where the Trump administration withdrew from the Paris Accord, the United States, once President Biden was elected and in office, submitted its what's known as a nationally determined contribution, which is what the United States is committing to doing under the Paris Agreement. And in this case, the U.S. set an economy-wide target of reducing its net greenhouse gas emissions by 50% below 2005 levels by 2030. While there's many sectors to be able to achieve this goal, the biggest ones tend to be power generation, which the EPA versus West Virginia one dealt with, transportation and buildings, not to mention agriculture, lands, non-carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. And so this really puts a more of a challenge in meeting that with electricity generation, which is what this dealt with, is does the EPA have the ability to regulate carbon dioxide as produced by power plants. So while this is just one of many sectors that have to be addressed to meet our nationally determined contribution or our Paris Agreement target, it is a big sector of the United States. There are other ways, however, that the administration can deal with it. There are other laws in place that we can deal with, and I can go into that a little later if you want.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Supreme Court case West Virginia v. EPA and its impact on environmental protection with Joel Mintz of Nova Southeastern University Law Center, Pete Andrews of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Pamela Chasick of Manhattan College. Pete Andrews, when you introduced the idea of the creation of the EPA, one of the things you emphasized was a bipartisan consensus. Environmental protection has become a pretty hotly contested partisan issue. Why is that? Why have we lost the bipartisan sense of a need for environmental protection?
Well, Richard Nixon, who began it, it was an interesting man. I mean, he wasn't initially, he had no record on the environment at all. One radio address in the campaign that he mentioned, I think. But he saw that it was popular, and he saw that his two potential rivals in 1972, Senator Muskie and Senator Jackson, were riding this issue very hard. Senator Muskie was the father of much of the pollution control legislation in the Senate, and Jackson was the father of the National Environmental Policy Act. So when he saw the Earth Day and the other things, the popular way of putting it is he saw a mob coming at him and he jumped in front of it and called it a parade. But the result was that he actually did a great deal for the environment until he decided it was politically unpopular and with his business base at that time to do so. I mean, he created the EPA, he issued, challenged Congress with, I think, 37 executive orders and other kinds of actions. In my whole original home state of Rhode Island, he required the Navy to clean up their pollution from ships, which was huge. But he did a great deal. He appointed good people. Basically, he, unlike some more recent presidents, he governed toward the center. He decided the right wing had no place else to go but him. And so he governed toward the center, put Bill Ruckelshaus in charge of the EPA, other good people. Now, how did that end? Nixon himself had political doubts about it by the 1972 election. He was saying, what am I getting for all this? Now, the Democrats are always going to be more willing to take aggressive government action than conservative Republicans. But he was, of course, left office, and Ford signed a number of further environmental laws. But then toward the end of 1970s, the cumulative effect of all those regulatory mandates, and they were largely regulatory mandates, right? It was only in the late 70s that EPA and others began to think about market-oriented incentives rather than regulatory mandates. And so a lot of the businesses began to push back. And Reagan, of course, then attempted a radical change back. He failed at that. The public was still very mobilized, and the Congress was largely more Democratic than it is today. And George H.W. Bush was Reagan's vice president, but then tried to run in 1988 as an environment-friendly, an environmental, you know, a Republican conservationist, which he was in many ways. But then in 1992, he faced Clinton with his vice presidential candidate of Al Gore, one of the most outspoken environmental congressmen. And I think the Republican Party just decided at that point, they threw up their hands and said, you know, we're just going to go with the opposite, with the small government, the anti-regulatory forces. And Newt Gingrich in Congress then, you know, pushed that very hard. Clinton beat him at it. You know, Gingrich tried to shut down the government, and Clinton basically dared him and won re-election on that issue. And in 2000, of course, Gore was running against George W. Bush, and the environmental groups went solidly with Gore, and which meant that when Bush was declared the winner by the Supreme Court, he didn't owe them anything, and so he too went largely the other way. And with Gingrich's approach to politics, and then George W. Bush's just pushing for base-oriented politics rather than for trying to win the allegiance of moderates in the middle, it's been, I mean, the biggest problem, the big elephant in the room, is a dysfunctional Congress, frankly. We almost got, you know, under Obama, in his early years, we almost got cap and trade legislation, but it died in the Senate with the economic situation falling apart and so forth. And it's a tragedy that it's become so partisanized, let me say. There are a lot of good Republican conservationists out there in the real world. If you look at the success of the Trust for Public Lands, Audubon, others that work with both sides to conserve public lands and so forth. But at the federal political level, it's become, particularly in Congress and among the candidates for president, it's become really dysfunctionally a partisan colored issue, which is too bad. Getting back to this decision, the West Virginia decision, that's the really sad thing about that is, you know, they didn't, on the one hand, they did not stop EPA from regulating climate change. I mean, EPA, from power plants, EPA has other ways that are still, they were not thrown out by that court. But what the court did was it barred them from using the most economically efficient way of allowing the power plants in the states to figure out a mix of generation that would achieve climate goals in the most business-friendly way. And it's really sad that they've done that. I'd welcome Joel's thought about this. I'm not a lawyer.
I completely agree with you, Pete. I think you're spot on with your comments there. And as I mentioned, this West Virginia opinion really takes away the authority of agencies in a very significant way and leaves it to Congress. And Congress, in the last several years at least, has really been in gridlock, unable to pass very much legislation, almost no legislation, and barely able to pass a budget to keep the government open. I mean, it's really become a rather dysfunctional institution. And yet the court has said, well, you know, agencies, despite their expertise, can't go ahead unless Congress very specifically, grants them the power to do it. So it's really, it's very troubling.
And Pam Chasick, you had some comments on this as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I totally agreed with Pete's history. And going back to my days in Washington at the National Wildlife Federation during the very end of Reagan through Bush and into Clinton. One of the things that also happened then is when Clinton and Gore got elected in 1992, there was a decrease of interest in environmental groups. They felt now that Al Gore was in the White House, you found contributions to environmental organizations dropped, activism dropped, because you felt, wrongly so, that you had an environmentalist in the White House. Let's focus on other issues, not just, so there was quite a bit of retrenchment in some of the large national environmental organizations during that period, which ended up being the totally wrong period to do so. Whereas the Reagan administration was one of the biggest draws and led to unprecedented growth for environmental organizations. So it was an interesting time that way as well. And that did not help through the Gingrich revolution of trying to keep members of Congress on the side of strengthening and enforcing environmental regulations. Just that's more of a personal point of personal privilege versus, scholarly work.
No, absolutely. But also, Joel Mintz, I know you've done work with the APA and in enforcement. I guess one of the questions I have, there's always been this complaint that the EPA is overly regulatory and damaging for business. What exactly has been the EPA's relationship, with the business community? Is this an antagonistic relationship that EPA is calling, and so businesses start, calling their attorneys?
Well, it's a complicated relationship. I mean, for one thing, the business community is not a monolith. There are companies that are quite sympathetic to environmental protection. There are companies that manufacture pollution control equipment that profit from environmental protection. So, it's again, it's not a monolith, but there are companies as well that for ideological reasons as well as economic reasons, absolutely flatly oppose any form of government regulation. And they have become politically potent, mostly through contributions from wealthy private individuals who have formed a whole network of NGOs that are opposed to environmental protection and really regulation generally. They're sort of a libertarian coalition. So as they became more powerful, the regulation has suffered and, continues to. It's still a very complicated picture. There's all kinds of tugging and pulling going in all kinds of directions on various issues. And it's not the same as to all issues, not the same as to water as compared to air, not the same as to various issues within water and within air and within toxic substances and within hazardous waste and so on. So it's, it's a mixed picture in that sense.
Yes, Pete Andrews.
Let me just add to Joel's comment that another piece of the history is that ever since the mid-1970s, Joel spoke repeatedly about the regulatory role of EPA, and ever since the mid-1970s, it's actually been some of the people in EPA, as well as outside economists, that have been arguing for different kinds of approaches to solving the pollution problem, not simply just, brutal regulation, if you will, but things like cap and trade, pollution taxes, things like that. There's a whole community among free market economists in the U.S. that has been advocating those things since even before EPA was created, since the late 60s. But within EPA itself, in the mid-70s, people in the EPA policy shop recognized that if they started to really lower the boom on air pollution in Los Angeles, it was going to shut that city's economy down. It was such a big problem. LA was way beyond the limits that were justified by protecting public health. So they started inventing, before they had the statutes to do it, they started inventing ways of dealing with this problem. For example, with, you know, literally EPA should have been regulated by the law. EPA should have regulated every smokestack and vent and so forth. EPA said, no, we can't do that. We'll imagine there's a bubble over every factory, every industrial plant, and that will regulate pollution, the net pollution that comes out of that bubble, rather than the whole thing. And we'll let them trade pollution, emission rights. These came from within EPA's ways, better ways of doing it. And in 1977, Congress ratified a number of those things. And so that we've had in that case, and in phasing down lead out of gasoline, for example, allowing the different factories to, makers to trade pollution with each other so that you achieve the overall goal, but you don't, hammer every company the same way. But the myth of just brute force regulation has lived on and been exploited by propagandists for the folks that Joel was mentioning. But really, and again, that comes back to this, to the West Virginia decision that took away EPA's power to allow the states and the companies and the power plants to figure out among themselves how to create a better mix of generation in order to achieve an important public goal and one that was justified by the economics. It's kind of a perverse decision and a kind of perverse situation the way there are people in the Republican Party who recognize this, and there'll be a few people who've been trying to put cap and trade, for example, back on the table, or an emission tax or something like that. But it's people in both parties. But the dominant forces on the Republican side have been really pretty hard on some stereotypes here.
Pam Chasek, you had a response as well.
Just to tack on to that the cap and trade for air pollution was largely supported by the Republican Party as a market mechanism rather than this top-down regulation. So when it came to air pollution, cap and trade was Republicans were really happy. Let's use market mechanisms to deal with this. But when you put this, but if you see the evolution and the movement of the Republican Party to the right, putting forth that same proposal for using cap and trade when dealing with greenhouse gas emissions suddenly was anathema to them, that, oh no, we can't possibly do that. Even though the whole notion of cap and trade came out of that desire to use market mechanisms.
Yeah, Pam, and also that action by under George H.W. Bush's administration that created the 1990 Clean Air Act, it was supported by Republicans, and it was wildly successful. It's been one of the most important reforms in environmental policy that we have seen, certainly probably the most important in the last 30 years. And so the success is on the table, and you could see the same kind of success happening with climate change and with greenhouse gases as well, if they would let it happen.
Yeah, just to add on to that, the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments passed under George H.W. Bush was the last time the Clean Air Act has been amended.
That's right.
And yeah. So we need to, that's something else. If Congress were able to do anything, the Clean Air Act could be amended to allow this regulation of greenhouse gas emissions, which the court said, Congress needs to do.
Joel Mintz?
Other environmental statutes have not been amended either. I mean, there's really been a deadlock in Congress that has frozen in place statutes that are becoming outmoded, that are outmoded in many cases, and that need to be refurbished and recertified.
There are one or two exceptions to that. There was a reform of the Toxic Substances Control Act. Although under the Trump administration, that was undermined in its implementation by the people who were put in charge of it. And there has also been some really extraordinary bipartisan public lands laws that have passed, a whole different side of the environmental issue. But on that one, on public land laws, there has been some much more significant bipartisan legislation passed. But uh, but the environmental laws, you know, the pollution control laws and so forth have been neglected.
Pam Chasek, you had a response.
Just to add on to that real quick, Doug, sorry, that the Toxic Substances Control Act, which was amended in 2016, right at the end of the Obama administration, some have gone to say that perhaps that could be used to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, because it is not as, you know, there's not as many loopholes within it, if that's the right, I'm not a lawyer either, terminology as you have under the Clean Air Act, and that you could easily say that greenhouse gas emissions is can be considered a toxic substance. So some have argued that in addition to using other parts of the Clean Air Act, that TSCA can also be used perhaps to deal with greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, and with that, we will take a break. When we return, we're going to discuss first, what does this decision, the West Virginia versus EPA decision, mean for the concept of judicial restraint versus judicial activism, in particular, the so-called major questions doctrine that came out of that? And then what can the U.S., and in particular, what can the EPA do in light of some of these challenges to implement a number of the environmental initiatives that that it would like to take on?
Please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today, we're discussing the West Virginia versus EPA decision, what this means for environmental protection, environmental regulation, environmental management in the United States, as well as its ability to make international commitments on environmental protection. Our panel today is Joel Mintz, Professor Emeritus of Law, and C. William Trout, Senior Fellow in Public Interest Law at Nova Southeastern University Law Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Pete Andrews, Faculty Fellow of the Institute for the Environment and Professor Emeritus in the Department of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Pamela Chasek, Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at Manhattan College. Joel Mintz, I'd like to turn to you. I learned that there's something now called the major questions doctrine with the Supreme Court. What is the major questions doctrine, and what does this mean for concepts of judicial restraint, judicial activism?
The basic notion is that where there is a major question, that a question having a major economic or political significance, the courts may strike down any federal agency regulation that is not specifically authorized or authorized by Congress. If Congress hasn't explicitly given a power to an agency, then the presumption after the major questions doctrine is the agency can't do it, and it's got to get a more specific authorization from Congress. So that's the basic doctrine. There are a number of problems with it, one of which is that Congress delegates to agencies this important decisions about regulation because agencies have expertise that Congress does not have. And Congress is a bunch of generalists, a bunch of politicians who are elected, and they may have some understanding of some technical issues, but not close to the expertise that agencies have. And the major questions doctrine says, well, never mind that expertise that the agencies have, You know, if the Congress has not very specifically gotten into these technical questions and made a pronouncement as to what has to be done, then the agency can't go forward. The agency is stymied in terms of creating new regulations. So it's a huge change.
Yeah, and who determines whether it's a major question?
Well, the courts. And, you know, what is a major question? I mean, there's no real definition given in the opinion. There's, except it's, you know, something of great political and economic significance. But, you know, how do you determine that? I mean, that's there's no guidance as to that, really. So it kind of gives the courts carte blanche to upend legislation, upend regulations as it sees fit based on the judgment of the judges who are making the decisions. That's never been their role in the past. So it's a real attempt to take more power into the judiciary as compared to agencies and Congress.
Yes, Pete Anders.
Yeah, related to that, Joel, I mean, there's the whole, there's been a debate about this for a long time, ever since the Chevron decision, in a decision involving the Chevron company, the courts set a standard for the extent to which the courts would intervene to challenge the agency's interpretations of the law, and basically decided that they would tend to refrain from doing that. I mean, EPA is actually more accountable to the public than the courts are. The courts are elected for life, the federal courts. They are appointed for life, I should say. And so this creates the situation that we've long had with people struggling with the problem of pornography, that we don't have a good definition of it. The courts have just said, well, we know it when we see it. But that means that it's the judgment of a politically, informed person with no accountability to the public beyond their own values and ability to put something on paper. Whereas the EPA, if EPA does something, it has an extensive justification process that it has to go through, showing that it's following the law and the Constitution. And those findings are themselves challengeable in court, but as well as by the Congress, who can, as I said, can decide that no, we disagree, we're stopping EPA from doing that, or we're cutting off funding for EPA to doing that. And Congress has often done that. And this throws the whole thing into a much more unaccountable political decision-making process by individual judges in individual circuits.
And it certainly seems to paint a picture here that the EPA and how aggressive the EPA would be is partially a function of their own expertise, certainly partially a function of the political appointment. So, who gets elected president, that's going to make a determination. Is it fair to say then this is the court saying no matter how the elections turn out, we can just overturn this and make it particularly difficult for any sort of environmental regulation? Pete Anders, I'll ask you that as a follow-up.
Yes. I mean, that's a problem. It's also going to throw a lot of confusion because, we have, nine federal circuits and however many district courts. And we've still got this function where, at least in some circumstances, individual judges can issue a nationwide injunction. So people who don't like the outcome can go forum shop and find, somebody they like or a judge they like of either the left or the right, or whoever it happens to be, and get them to say, well, I think this is a major question. Boom, there goes an entire national program that people have put a lot of effort into justifying and showing that it complies with the law.
Now, Pam Chasick, you are offering me some optimism that there may be creative ways that agencies, specifically the Environmental Protection Agency, but perhaps even other agencies, might be able to make, to take certain types of actions, perhaps even make commitments. You referenced one with the Toxic Substance Act. What are some of the others that seem to be on the table?
There are some other options that the Biden administration can look towards. The challenges are, once again, if you're, you know, can't totally remove electric power generation from the picture. What we've seen in recent years as more and more electric power generation companies have moved away from coal because it's too expensive, and they've moved on to natural gas, which was one of the options under, you know, as a sort of a bridge option under both, you know, what Biden would like to do, as well as what the nationally determined contribution, or NDC, says that it'll do, that was submitted under Paris. And so that's, you know, the power generation sector is a big one. Another areas where we can deal with greenhouse gas emission reductions is in the transportation sector. And the largest sources of emissions are from SUVs, pickup trucks, and cars, followed by heavy trucks, aircraft, rail, and ships. And 90% of our transportation energy comes from petroleum. So can we move away from petroleum? You know, yes, there's problems with everything. I admit that. But if you move towards more electric vehicles, of which the electricity is being produced from clean sources of power, not coal in particular, we can reduce our emissions. Can we invest in building light rail, in other forms of mass transit, bicycle paths, pedestrian improvements, ways so that people are not always driving? Some parts of the country, that's not very doable. In other parts of the country, particularly the urban areas, that is doable. And we're seeing probably the greatest movement towards reduction of greenhouse gas emissions taking place right now in cities. And then finally, in buildings is your third area, where how can we make, you know, can we put things into place to not only reduce the energy burden on consumers and making buildings more fuel efficient. New York State and New York City First, and now New York State, has put a ban on heating oil used in new construction. Some of the older construction, you know, you can't, retrofitting is just exorbitant, but now you cannot propose any new construction that uses fuel oil for heat. And yeah, and also there's a movement away from natural gas in terms of gas for all you gas stove loving people. And all of this also has human health related implications. Industry is another sector where the United States, the government, can support research and development and commercialization and deployment of technologies that reduce emissions. Agriculture is a huge source. and so I think, and also non-CO2 greenhouse gas emissions. So particularly, you know, hydrofluorocarbons, which are actually regulated under the Montreal Protocol. And the United States has ratified the Kigali Amendment that regulates HFCs. And HFCs are potent greenhouse gas gases that the United States now has the ability to regulate under the Montreal Protocol. So there's a lot of different areas. This is a you know, the EPA versus West Virginia is a problem. I can't, you know, minimize that in any way, but it doesn't mean we're out of options. It's just going to take more creativity.
And to add, if I may, to what Pam Chasek said, there are, and getting back to CO2 emissions at power plants, which are, I understand contribute 40% of the carbon dioxide emissions in the country, there are a couple of options still left available after West Virginia against EPA. One of them is simply to run plants more efficiently in order to reduce CO2 emissions. You'd think that companies would be doing that anyway because it saves money, but they don't all. They're not all helping themselves and their shareholders in that way. And that's one option. Another is to shift load from coal-fired plants to gas-fired plants owned by the same company. That could be done, and it's known as generation shifting in the language that the court used. And it's certainly an option. Another is for the power companies to build solar arrays and wind farms. Some of them are doing that, some of them aren't. And finally, purchase renewable power from existing facilities, from other power companies that are producing power in a cleaner way. So those are options that are still left available under West Virginia against EPA. There's no mandate that companies do that at the moment, but EPA still can regulate in those ways. Whether the court will allow that in future is an open question.
Yes, Pete Andrews.
Even for power plants, EPA can regulate the non-climate change air pollution impact in ways that also happen to achieve greenhouse gas reduction. There are other pollutants that co-pollute with greenhouse gases and so forth. And as you said, companies can generation shift themselves. It's just EPA has been told they can't mandate generation shifting beyond the individual across plants or across sources.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Supreme Court case, West Virginia v. EPA, and its impact on environmental protection with Joel Mintz of Nova Southeastern University Law Center, Pete Andrews of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Pamela Chasick of Manhattan College. And I guess, Pete Andrews, then a lot of what we're describing here is how much can we expect a commitment from industry to make these choices? Certainly consumers would have a role to play in this if they're demanding greener products. I guess one of the big challenges at industry-centric approaches is just how committed, is industry to making these green choices, and concerns about, greenwashing, especially if the EPA is not regulating, how effective is the data collection where we can even as consumers know who actually are the greener companies?
Well, that gets into another kind of issue that is on the table for court consideration right now, which is the Securities Exchange Commission is, preparing rules that would demand more disclosure of climate impacts by companies as a business matter. SEC argues that climate impacts are a business risk, that they have a right and an obligation to have companies disclose. And I know when back in the 1970s, we had when companies were complaining about regulation for other pollutants and so forth, there came a move from the business community itself to recognize that pollution by any other name is waste. That they were throwing away materials and energy that they'd had to pay for. And so the whole movement toward pollution prevention pays by was a corporate-led initiative, and once people caught on to that, they began to look at all their costs and so forth, and discover that in fact they could save money by being less by reducing pollution and so forth. Now, that's a little harder for companies like companies running old power plants, legacy facilities that they want to keep running. The question is, at what point do you really put legacy facilities to bed and do something else? And the hard part for power companies is that's real for coal plants. Partly due to regulation, but also just more generally, coal plants are not economical in most cases to run right now. And so most of the utilities are now quickly or slowly getting out of them. The challenge, for the future of energy is that that's also happened to nuclear power, because nuclear power is also high cost, although it has much better climate implications. And so that both of those are technologies that are just being just straight out in the business world outpriced right now, and particularly as solar and wind become more prevalent and you get them able to balance their loads between each other, so you don't have the argument about the sun doesn't shine at night or the wind doesn't blow in the daytime and so forth. That's the world is changing, and a lot of the companies, even some of the big ones, Duke Energy, for example, has a major renewables program going right now, and they're one of the biggest utilities in the country, if not the biggest. And I'm sure people could speak up for some of the other power plants, but there are others that are just sitting in states and other industries that are sitting in states that are legacy industries that were clobbered by globalization and by the 2008 economic meltdown and so forth. And those people and those jobs and those companies are hurting.
On the same line, I remember in 2005 when we seemingly hit, you know, peak oil at, you know, at some point, the transition to alternative energy vehicles was pretty dramatic. And now with the gas prices, you know, with so the price of a barrel of oil is not as high, you know, as it was then, but the price of a gallon of gas is, you know, shot up. I can't imagine people aren't thinking about, let's get rid of my SUV and get a hybrid vehicle just out of cost. But Pam Chasek, also on this question of reporting, you mentioned the only real obligation the U.S. has with the Paris Climate Accords was to report on these areas. And I know that data collection, you know, the sort of the climate scorecard is one of the most important things that have come out of the Paris Accords. How much can consumers who are considering, you know, greener companies, are they able to rely on some of the reporting coming out of Paris to be able to make informed choices?
Well, it's not so much coming out of Paris necessarily, but, you know, to make informed choices, you have to see what, you know, what corporations are saying, you know, in terms of reducing their own environmental or carbon footprint, and then do you believe them or are they merely greenwashing? And that does take, some work, and that's independent of Paris. Labeling, green labeling has been going on for quite some time, and whether you're buying, what products you're buying, what you're doing, avoiding things like fast fashion, avoiding food waste, trying to support, imperfect foods and other, they don't have to look absolutely pretty. Supporting local farmers. There's a whole bunch of things that you can do in your own consuming that have nothing to do with Paris. When it comes to Paris, though, we're about to embark on what's called the global stocktake. This was mandated under Paris that governments will be reporting in on the implementation of their NDCs and hopefully ratcheting up those commitments. We saw the push for that in Glasgow last year. This year in Sharm el-Sheikh, is the beginning. They're setting in place what will be the global stocktake that'll, leading up to the COP in 2023. And this is where governments are required to report in on how they have gone about implementing their commitments and do they think they'll meet their commitments. Regardless, though, the commitments that are already on the books, we're not going to keep climate change below 1.5 degrees Celsius. It's sadly not going to happen. Can we keep it below 2? Right now, it does not look that way, regardless of what the US does. Countries have to vastly up their commitments. And as we've seen with the war in Ukraine, as we've seen with the rising price of fuel right now, and the fact that President Biden is going off to Saudi Arabia to ask them to pump more oil. What does that do for climate change? Yes, it's a short-term political interest. And that's what's affecting many countries around the world right now is short-term political interests over long-term health of the climate, health of the population, and the future of a number of countries.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what Pam just suggested. And it's worth noting, I think, that since the Paris Accords, there's been a significant increase in atmospheric CO2 as measured in Mauna Loa, in the Hawaiian Islands, and at other observatories around the world. So, if you just measure it in terms of how much the problem has been addressed and ameliorated, it really hasn't worked out. It's just a failure.
Actually, we've got about 90 seconds left. Joel Mintz, I do want to ask you one last question. And that is, how optimistic, we keep hearing that West Virginia versus EPA is just the start, and this could get much worse. Do you anticipate that the court's interventions to make it more difficult to regulate the environment is going to get worse?
It's entirely possible. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what the court has in mind. Maybe they'll decide to leave this alone and make changes in other areas. They have some significant civil rights cases coming up, and so maybe they will call a halt to what they're doing. But the lower courts will be following up with the court's rulings, and they can go in all different directions and probably will. So it's going to be interesting to watch. And, you know, I can't say I'm overly optimistic at what's going to happen.
But there's also the important thing of what the states will do. And some of the states, at least, will continue to lead on this, while some will not.
I agree completely. Absolutely right.
We've been discussing the West Virginia versus EPA decision that came down from the Supreme Court of the United States. The practical impact is to weaken the EPA, at least on one significant issue, the enforcement of the Clean Air Act, and certainly offers the ability for the courts to continue to weaken environmental regulations, environmental protection in a number of different areas. Our panel today has been Joel Mintz, Professor Emeritus of Law, and C. William Trout, Senior Fellow in Public Interest Law at Nova Southeastern University Law Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He is the author of Enforcement at the EPA, High Stakes and Hard Choices. Pete Andrews is Faculty Fellow of the Institute for the Environment and Professor Emeritus in the Department of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He is the author of Managing the Environment, Managing Ourselves, A History of American Environmental Policy. And Pamela Chasek, Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at Manhattan College. She is the author of Global Environmental Politics. Thank you all very much for joining us. I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.